Well, I think, you certainly have been a great example for everybody through all the years. And I know that at least I read, and you could tell me a little bit about it, but I read where that there was some conflict because of games being played on Sunday. And I know that that was against your faith, but then you also had the, at least I read, the attitude that, well, that was part of the contract, and it was a, like farmers have to work every day of the week. And
Exactly. Sometimes you have to do what if you see the ox in the mire, you got to get them out.
yeah,
Well,
right.
with me, it was an issue, but when I talked to our prophet back then about this, it was President McKay, who was not only a good athlete himself, but a person who communicated with God, and got answers to the challenges and problems. And then when I went to him and talked to him about his, I told him how this issue was, with me, that I just didn't feel right about playing baseball on Sunday because the Sabbath he created for other things, not games and things like that, but he says, "Well, he says, Vernie says, you were a farmer. Your dad was farming. What did you have to do on Sunday?" I said, "Well, we had to get up and milk the cows and take care of the animals and so forth." He says, "Well, that was your livelihood, was it not?" And he says, "Yes. Well, now, sir, you have signed a baseball contract, and your contract is something that you must live up to, And so it was then that I felt a little bit better about playing on Sunday because I had his approval of to do this and feel good about it. And so that was an issue for me, but then I got over that and was able to do what I was asked to do. If my turn came around on Sunday, I went to church, but I always have a cab there waiting for me to get in there and get to the ballpark in time to take care of business,
Yeah, that's
So,
great.
yeah.
There's
So
a
that's what you're supposed to do.
yes.
You don't have to abandon things that you believe in. You can still do things and still do your job, which I tried to do the best I could.
You sure did. There's something I'd like to read to you, okay? Just for a second. It's now you tell me who you think said this. Live clean lives. Leave tobacco and alcohol alone. A lot of practice is necessary. Don't get discouraged at your position. Create within yourself a competitive spirit and a desire to win no matter what the odds. Be good listeners to your coaches or anyone who knows anything about baseball. They may have the answer to your problem. Weigh all their advice, and if any of it proves helpful, use it to your advantage. Does that sound familiar?
Sure does. That's very true. I think
Well,
when
you
I
had that
see
on the
other
back of a, it
people.
was advice, it was Vern Law's advice to youngsters. And I just thought that was fantastic.
Well, thank you. Well, the guys on the team, I give my teammates a lot of credit too. Matter of fact, Bob Prince. Sometimes, if you wanted to go to a good restaurant, you have to walk through the bar to get there, get to the back and have a good dinner. I would never go in. I would never go in. They said, "Why don't you do that, Deacon?" I said, "Well, what if somebody who knows what I stand for sees me walk into that bar? That's not that's not." They could draw all kinds of conclusions, So they said, "Okay, Deacon, all right, it's okay." So anyway, but Bob Prince was, and I give him a lot of credit too for, he's everybody called me Deacon, on the team, the umpires, opposing players, fans, there goes the Deacon or whatever, they. And that opened a lot of doors for me to and like I say, the old ball players, they sign, they will you know, go to businesses where they're opening up a new business or something. They get a little bit of money and put it in their pocket for making these appearances and so forth. Well, I got all the churches and little leagues and banquets and those kinds of things. And the money that they got is spent and forgotten, but some of the experiences I had, I'll never forget because of the environment and maybe the impression that is left there because the things that I have seen, for example, out in L.A., I'm usually one of the first ones to get out and get into the bus. And I go through the crowd of people, I sign autographs, and finally get on the bus. Well, and then we usually had one guy on our team who was always late. He was always the last one. And he come through with a cigarette in his mouth, and before he got on it, he threw the bus, the cigarette down, and there was a little young man down there sitting and standing waiting to get an autograph or whatever, and he went right past him and he looked at that cigarette and just kind of like it was the wrong thing to do. He kind of eased over, put his foot on the cigarette and crushed it out. If you could have seen the look on this boy's face, you would have got the message that I got. But here was an athlete that he thought he shouldn't be smoking for the first time. But, right. You know, and he was disappointed. The look on his face was really a message in and of itself. And so, I tell you, I will never forget that.
Do you think that player, do you think he realized what he was doing at that time? Or?
Well, you know, some of them don't think about those things, you know. I think an athlete should take care of himself, don't smoke or drink in public, you know. Try to, if you would. Sometimes they, you know, where does bad things really happen? In bars, you know. Yeah. There's nothing good inside a bar. If you want to have a good time, you don't go there. Yeah. You know, and that's, there's so many people that are not, I think you know as many instances as I do where there's been shootings, there's been fights, there's been ball players got in trouble in there, you know, and that's not the right place or the right thing athletes should do. All right. Matter of fact, with Babe Ruth, I wasn't too impressed because he was sitting up there with a cigar in his mouth, but he wasn't smoking it. He's chewing on it. You know, but that didn't leave me with a very good impression. He also had a beer that he was drinking, and I wasn't impressed with that. I thought, I didn't expect to see something like that from Babe Ruth. But yeah. I did. I was a young man, and it was very, you know, you leave a very poor impression when you do those things and where people know and have morals and standards that they try to live by, and then you see people breaking those things that you believe in, and even though they have no, they don't have a second thought about it, I don't know. But to me, I was always told, you know, that an athlete should take care of himself, you know, work hard, you know, and do the things you can to make yourself better than you possibly can. But anyway, that's my feeling, but. Now, some of the players they don't think about that, you know. They just think it's a natural thing to do. They see it on television. I can go back a long time ago when it's doing all their advertising on TV, there'd be a woman standing there, but she wouldn't be smoking, but he would be smoking. And then it wasn't long after that you could see her holding the cigarette, and then pretty soon after that she was smoking. Well, they accomplished that. Now women smoke, and so now they start pushing it on the little kids, you know, they're teenagers. And so, you know, it's a bad habit, you know. It's just like anything else. I know I could probably cut back on ice cream.
Me too.
But the word of wisdom is, you know, just use common sense. Use good, you know, judgment about things. And so, yeah, you've got to, especially when you're in a position to impress young people, to help them not make mistakes, you know. I remember walking down the streets in Pittsburgh. I can hear them say, these kids playing ball, and you hear them say, well, I'm Mads or whatever, you know. They pretend, you know. And so it's important, I think, that athletes take care of themselves in a different way than what some of them are doing, you know, and try to make the kind of impression you'd like to have your own children, you know, see and grow up with, you know. Sometimes these habits are just too tough to break, I guess, for some of them.
Well, I pretended I was Vern Law, and you're my hero, and you never let me down, I'll tell you.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, I appreciate it. You bet.
You know, it's funny. I remember seeing ads on YouTube, and they'll have, you know, these old cigarette advertisements. They'll have Lou Burdette for you know, Pall Mall, or Preacher Row for Camels. And
yeah,
yeah, it was prevalent.
You know, during the World Series, I got a call from New York. I was in the clubhouse. It says, Deacon, you're wanted on the phone. I go over there, and it says, this is so-and-so from Marlboro Cigarettes. We'd like to have you sign a contract with us, you know. And I was shocked, because I've been so outspoken about that, you know. And I said, I was dumbfounded for me. And I said, well, sir, I says, I think it's wrong that any athlete should sign and let people use their name when on products is not good and healthy, for especially for children, and so, you know, I just felt it wrong, and I said, no, I can't do this, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, is there anybody else there I can sign it to get you to talk to? And I said, well, I named a guy, and I said, well, he signed with Camels, you know, and so on. There's another one over here. And I said, funny, I called Bill Verdon over. I said, Bill, this guy would like to talk to you. And before I walked away, I heard Bill say, well, I'm sorry, I don't smoke. You can't use my name either, you know. So anyway.
Were there a lot of did a lot of players smoke?
I'm from Marlboro Country, I guess. You know, I lived out there in the sagebrush.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so anyway, that's the only recommendation I could say I had, was I lived in that kind of country where, you know, you could probably advertise and get away with it, but no. But anyway, that was the interesting thing. I didn't ask them how much. I don't know how much they would have given me to do that. I'm sure it'd be probably as much as I was making in baseball. But anyway, I'm glad that I had sense enough to say no.
Oh, yeah. Well,
instead of saying how much.
Was there a lot of your teammates, did they smoke?
I beg your pardon?
Did a lot of your teammates smoke?
Yes. Yeah, there were... there were a few on our team, but matter of fact, I told Harvey Haddix, I says, Harv, these cigarettes are going to kill you, man. No, why don't you quit? You know, you don't need those, you know. And Dick Grote, he would in spring training, he would quit, and I'd. Happy for him, you know, but all of a sudden during the season, I noticed him take one or two, you know, but he really slowed it down, but he didn't completely quit. But I think eventually he has quit, you know. I'm positive he has,
yeah,
which is good for him. But Harvey, when he was signed on as a coach afterwards, he quit for a while too, but then he'd pick it back up. I guess that's the toughest thing to get rid of is the nicotine, you know, the smoke.
Yeah.
And so but finally Harvey, after coaching in Pittsburgh, even my son who played for Pittsburgh at that time, he'd come up to Vance and he said, "Vance, why don't you have a cigarette?" He'd come over and teach some Vance and say, "Hey, Vance, you had a great day, have a beer." And he says, "Harvey, you know I don't smoke and I don't drink." He says, "No, I'm just testing you, you know." Harvey was a great guy, a good friend, you know, and
yeah.
I loved the guy.
Sure.
And I think everybody that played with him felt the same way. But when he got emphysema, it got so bad that he could hardly breathe.
What a tragic shame.
Eventually it took his life. I warned Harvey. I said, "Harvey, please quit. You're too nice of a guy to keep this habit up, you know." But he just couldn't get rid of it, you know, and eventually it killed him, you know.
Aww.
It took his life before it should have, you know. I mean, he was a sturdy, strong kid growing up and also playing baseball. But that habit eventually took his life, which I was really sorry to hear that happened, because I don't know if you've ever been in a hospital room or a room where a guy was struggling to breathe. It's not good.
No.
It's not good at all. And so, but that's the things that I tried to get him. I tried to get Prince. I said, "Bob, why, you don't need to smoke or drink or any of those kinds of things. Why don't you take better care of your health?" And, well, it's the same thing happened then. Well, he and Jim Woods, they said, "Well, I think I'll have another big C," you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Referring to the cigarette,
yes.
Big C. Well,
and
anyway,
Jim Woods was another announcer for the Pirates, the
yeah.
Possum, they called him. Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. So in 1950, you made it to the big leagues, and you played for the New Orleans Pelicans, and again, you were showing consistent improvement. You had a great year with the Pelicans. And then you went up to the Pirates, and you got to play for manager Billy Meyer. And as I understand, right. Honus Wagner was one of the coaches, and the GM was Branch Rickey. Is there any memories you have of Honus Wagner?
Oh, yes, I should say. Yeah, he was on the bench. He was on the bench every game. He'd be there at the ballpark, you know, and I wish I would have got a box of baseballs and had him autograph.
That would take care of all your financial needs.
Yeah, I did have him on a baseball with a teammate. I did have his name on one of the teammates. I'd ask him every once in a while, and usually I gave those balls away, but I did keep one that had his signature on it. He was a grand old gentleman, you know. If I had a bad day or something like that, I'd walk in, you know, and on the bench, and he says, "Hang in there, you'll be fine. Just, you know, just keep working hard. You'll be fine." You know, he encouraged me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but then about the seventh inning, he would always go in, and he would have. He'd have, Iron City. He'd have a couple Iron Cities. And then I never asked him about this, but I heard people say, you know, he did not buy a beer. He didn't have to. He would walk in these bars, and people would just say, you know, just have there. He'd give them a couple beers, you know, and then he might go to the next bar that they was familiar with, you know.
Yeah.
People say I don't think he ever bought a drink in his life, but he had all he wanted, for sure.
Did he work with the young players, or Did he work with you or any of the players in batting and fielding? Was he
Well,
active?
not really. I've never really seen him on the field, you know, instructing, or they might, you know, in my opinion, he probably talked to them. You know, I'm sure that he did talk to some of the guys about, you know, he could watch and evaluate you, you know, and see what's going. And I think that's why he kept encouraging me, because he saw something in me that probably would be good, you know. And so he would talk to me, you know, to hang in there and keep mm-hmm. encouraging me, and says, "You'll be fine. Just, you know, keep going and working hard. It'll turn around for you." Hmm. And so, anyway, yeah, but he's a grand old gentleman. He really was.
What can you recall about your very first major league ball game?
Well, I can recall a lot. Not only that one, but the second one too.
Oh yeah.
It was against Philadelphia, Robin Roberts.
Oh, he was quite a pitcher.
Yeah, we had a good game going. The score tied. We're going in the last inning. I've got two outs in the ninth inning, and they've got a man on second base. And so, anyway, of course, with two strikes on the hitter and everything, what happened was that with the score tied and everything, you know, when that guy swung the bat, and made connection, the guy's running. Well, this looper that he hit over the shortstop, Stan Rojak was the shortstop, Ralph Kiner was the outfielder. Rojak is going back, I got it, and then he hears Ralph coming in, and I don't know if Ralph said anything or not, but he could hear him coming in, so he stopped, the ball fell in, the run scored, and I got beat.
Oh, geez.
And then 4 days later, it was an instant replay. Same thing, me pitched against Roberts, we're in the ninth inning, same thing. I mean, it was, I just talked to myself, oh, well, I've seen this in high school. You know?
It's all like Groundhog Day.
Yeah, but those two guys were involved in the same situation, and I'll be darned if they didn't do the same thing again.
And they lost the game was lost?
I fell in for a base hit, and the run scores, and I'm beat again.
Oh, gee whiz. Wow.
Yeah.
So what?
Just like that. Well, you know, we wasn't very good early when in my career. I know there were so many instances where, you know, a break here or there, or an error, in most of the cases it was made or something. It's something that you just couldn't get turned around, you know. And it's like the BYU football team right now. We're right there on the edge every game we played. We could be 5-0. But no, mm-hmm. somebody would mess up, you know, mm-hmm. and we end up getting beat. And so, but anyway, we could also be 0-5, but we're not that. We're just 2-3 right now. And so, anyway.
Well, those early Pirate teams.
You get in a rut, it's hard to turn it around.
Oh,
you know?
Sure.
There's a lot of teams like that. When they lose, when you got the momentum, you better keep it. You know, just keep, but. A lot of times that another team will make a great play or something, or you don't score when you got the bases loaded and one out or no outs and you don't score. That just takes the air out, you know, and pretty soon you get that. And the Mets were the same way when they first joined the league. They couldn't win for losing because, you know, if you could get to the seventh inning, somebody was going to make a mistake and you'd end up winning.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
And it's that mentality. And well, you can say what you believe, and if you don't believe it, you just watch it long enough, you know good and well that that's what happens. You know, that you get that mentality of losing, and that's what's going to happen no matter what. You said, oh, no, it's going to happen. We're just waiting for it to happen, you know, and sure,
sure.
enough it happens. But
well,
anyway.
Those early Pirate teams, they were pretty bad. There was some good players on them. You had like Ralph Kiner and Gus Bell, Wally Westlake, but they just couldn't seem to. Well, tell me, what was the experience of playing on those early Pirate teams?
Well, all I could do, you know, and my attitude was, I'm going out there, I'm going to do my very best, you know, I'm going to work hard, I'm going to do everything I can to win. And if someone else messes up, I'm sorry, I can't avoid that. That's going to happen, you know, but with my attitude that I had, every time I went out there, I was going out there to win, not to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my attitude, and I think that that's what kept me going, because there were so many times that we were not good. I'm just glad that I went in the Army and spent 2 years in the service while they were still struggling. They went and lost over 100 games, and you know, during the year in 50, I think it was 52.
52, yeah. Yeah, they did. They had a real bad year. They lost 112,
yeah,
I think.
I was kind of glad I was in the service at that time, you know.
Sure.
I didn't have to suffer with them.
Well, in 51, they started to, you know, they started getting some good players. They had Bob Friend and Frank Thomas, to name two.
Yeah.
So do you have any recollections on those fellas?
Well, you know, when we got Frank Thomas and also Gus Bell, you know, mm-hmm. and that started, I think that started because we started to be competitive around, as I remember, we started being competitive around 55, 56.
Yeah, yes.
We started, at least we were, got to the point where we had a chance to win, you know, and maybe we didn't, but we still were getting better at that point, yeah.
Oh, definitely. They started in 54. You know, in 51, they got Bob Friend and Frank Thomas. And when you came back from the service, then in 54, Bob Skinner came on the team, and Jerry Lynch and Bob Perkey. And
right.
Yeah, they had another pitcher named Max Sirkont. I don't know too much about him. And your catcher was Jack Shepard. Is that correct, or Toby Atwell?
Well, Toby Atwell was there. My first catcher I had was, starts his nut. His last name starts with his. I can see him now because he's the one that helped me quite a bit. And my first catchers. Says Deacon, well, you're not Deacon. He says, Vernon, he says, you're going to win a lot of games for us. Just, you know, just keep working hard, you know. And he really did help me. I'll think of his name probably after we hang up. anyway, he was, he helped me, you know, and encouraged me. So that made me feel good, you know, because even though we were losing, he was very positive in his talking to me, so that was good.
So, any thoughts of Bob Skinner, Bob Perkey?
Well, yeah. You know, I pitched with Bob Perkey in Class B League in Davenport, Iowa.
Oh.
So I was with Bob back then, you know, and we just worked together, you know, and he had a good year as well as I did, you know. Even though I didn't win a lot of games, my ERA was the same as his, and we again, you know, I had a lot of bad breaks during Davenport, but I was pitching well, you know, and that's. Had to get their earned run average and so forth. But anyway, that's...
So in Davenport, you were, let's see, you were 5-11?
Yes.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah. But you pitched good. Your ERA was
2.94. I think he had 18 wins, and yet we both had the same earned run average.
Oh, isn't that something? Mr. Law, I looked up the 1950. The catcher for the Pirates was Clyde McCulloch. McCulloch.
That's it. I knew it was a C. I
Yeah.
knew it started with a C, but I couldn't think of it. Yeah, it was Clyde McCulloch.
So he was
Yeah,
helpful then to a young pitcher.
he was kind of a funny guy too. He says he says that he'd go back there and catch without a mask on, anyway, he was a tough kid. Yeah, he was a tough guy growing up. Boy.
So when you were at the when you were at the stages, early years of when you first were on the Pirates, and when you came back from the military, you knew you made the team and no more minor leagues for you. And
Struggling a little bit because of my arm had, even during the service I couldn't pitch because of tearing my rotator cuff the first time. And but then after a year down in the service and so forth, I played on a town team there in Seaford, Virginia, and so I started to throw them again back then, and so my arm started to come around pretty good, and then of course when we got to spring training, why that certainly helped, but I needed to break down those adhesions that I had in there because that was what was keeping me from throwing hard. But anyway, I finally got to the point where I could throw without it hurting, and that made a difference. So, I was just glad the Pirates stuck with me, but they had to keep me because after you come off of the service, they had to keep you at least a year.
Well, good thing they did.
Yeah.
Now, when you were in the service, you played on some of the teams there, and did you? You were a very good hitter. So, did you also play outfield as well as pitch or any other
Well,
positions?
I played first base while I was on the team in the Army. But I had played some outfield. Matter of fact, even in Pittsburgh, I'd pitch the first game and play the outfield the second game.
You were that good of a, yeah, it was a good hitter, sure.
Well, Well, we had guys that struggled, and like you say, I could do a little bit with the bat, and I could run good, and I didn't have a bad glove. I could field my position okay, but I think if my arm hadn't come around, I think I could have still played in the big leagues because I think I had enough skills that I could have done that. Fortunately, I didn't have to because when my arm started coming around, I felt more comfortable about being on the mound.
Sure. Now, at that time when you came back from the Army, what was pitches did you have in your arsenal at that point?
I still had all my pitches, a fastball, breaking ball, and I could I change speeds. I change speeds. I do that, and I have a good change up. I could tell our hitters and bat backs I'm throwing a change up, and I'd still be out in front on it. It was good enough. It was good enough that I had enough control of it. I could, if the count came to 3-2, I wasn't afraid to throw anything because my control was good enough. I felt like I could throw a strike with it. And matter of fact, I remember one game in St. Louis where I was pitching, and this was in the ninth inning, and they had the bases loaded. We had a 1-0 lead, and Reuben Jones, no. It's the second baseman that took Mazur, that Maz took the job away from him.
Danny Murtaugh.
Let's see. I'm trying to think.
I could probably help you out here. Hold on. If
Yeah,
I
you
look
know,
at
but again, you know, some of the
Kurt Roberts,
names.
Kurt
No,
Roberts,
it wasn't Roberts. It
Johnny
wasn't
O'Brien.
Roberts. It was,
Was it one of the O'Brien twins?
no, it wasn't. It wasn't the Bryans. It was before. Well, let's see.
Maz came in
gosh.
56.
Yeah. No, it was just. It was. Well, it was in 56. You know, it was around that time. Because it was around that time that I think Maz, oh gosh, I'm just drawing a blank on him. But anyway, he was a hitter, a good fastball hitter, and I knew him from from past experiences that when you run a count to 3-2, he's looking nothing but fastball, you know, and so. I thought I'd run with this 1-0 lead. I threw a breaking ball. I threw a hard slider to him out there on the corner. He took it. Strike three. The game was over. But that's how much confidence I had in my control. You know, in the pitches that I had to throw.
Right.
That was the one that I went to at that point. And was, you know, he just didn't even offer to swing because it was a nice breaking ball right on the corner, and he. But he was looking fastball all the way on it, and so anyway, you know.
So you had a good, really good variety.
I had all my pitches. I had all my pitches back when I, by the time I got there, yeah.
Yeah, so you had a really good variety. Did you call your games yourself, or did the catcher? You know, like I know you had at one point Hank Foyles, and then Smokey Burgess and Hal Smith.
Well, Smokey was my catcher. You know, he caught me most all my games, and when he got there, and if I shook Smokey off on a pitch, the guy'd usually end up getting a base hit. And so I did, you know, Smokey, he called a good game for me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I very seldom ever, you know, it didn't take me long to learn my lesson. just show what he asked for. Because he can see things back there, what the hitter's doing as well as anybody,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he knew exactly how I wanted to pitch, you know. And if the situation got to a 3-2 count, I knew what he was going to call, you know. And I was always ready to throw whatever it was he called for, you know. And so that was a big plus for me to have a catcher like Smokey.
Mm-hmm.
Now Smokey. He didn't have a great arm. He's not going to throw out many people, but he'll also give me a couple base hits, too.
Oh, yeah. He was quite a hitter. Yeah, he
was a
very good pinch hitter as well.
Hitter.
In 1955, the Pirates really, this was the last year under Branch Rickey. I just wanted to get any thoughts you may have on Branch Rickey.
Well, I tell you. You know, I could tell you a lot about Branch, you know, because I spent quite a bit of time with him, with the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, you know, but even before all of the Christian Athletes, when he first came there, he knew about me, you know, and matter of fact, there was one point that the Cardinals wanted me, and he wouldn't let me go. You know, he thought that much of me to keep me there, and I'm glad that he did because it was after that, of course, we won the World Series. But
mm-hmm.
the thing is, one experience I had with him, which, and I knew that he was a good Christian man, you know, he made a promise to his mother that he would never be at the ballpark on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and he lived up to that promise. He was mm-hmm. never at the park on Sunday, and so, you know, and with my faith, you know, we're a full-time pair. And this was early in the years when he got there. We'd gone through the season, and, you know, we pay 10% tithing, you know, and I would usually have Vanita write it out, you know, and write out, you know, on our checkbook of 10% was, and we gave it to the church as a tithing. And we also have a donation where we fast one Sunday a month and take the money that we would have spent on this, on a dinner or whatever, and put that down, you know, as a fast offering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that money is used to give to people who are really struggling and need help, you know, and poor, being poor and don't have the money for food or whatever, rent or whatever. They use that fast offering for those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that we still do that even today, you know, mm-hmm. all through our lives we've done this. And so I had thought, you know, Vanita had gone home with the children, and I thought she had paid the tithing, and she thought I did because I was still in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, neither of us. Well, we were renting up a home there in Idaho, and so that amount that we owed was practically equal to what our rent was. And so what we had to make a decision, well, are we going to be a full tithe payer, or are we going to pay rent instead of tithing? Well, I said, let's pay our tithing. So we paid our tithing, and you know, a week later, in the mail, there came a check for $1,500. Branch Rickey felt that I had pitched well enough during the season that I deserved to have that. So, you know, I'm a believer in tithing.
Boy, isn't that amazing?
Because the promise is made. The promise made, if you are full tither, you will always have food on table. You won't have to worry about that. And it's been true. Been true our whole lives. That's the way it's been. And matter of fact, Bob Prince asked me to come back after the World Series and talk to his congregation there in East Hills.
Mm-hmm.
Not Mount Lebanon, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Is the Mount Lebanon, where the big church there.
Yes.
Methodist Church, Presbyterian Church. And so, anyway, he called and says, Bernie says, could you come back and talk to the our church that we go to on tithing? And I said, well, yeah, Bob, yeah, I'd be happy to come back and do that. And I said, but what's all this about? And I said, because I wanted to know, I said, well, now, how is this money going to be used, you know, and because I know what's used in our church, and I would hope that it would be the same thing with the church there. And he said, well, I'll tell you, our church is trying to raise funds for a missionary fund. And I said, well, yeah, I'd be happy to do that, you know, and so... Anyway, that's why I went back there, you know. And I quoted the scripture that where it says, you know, that a full tithing is 10% of your earnings that you give to the Lord, you know. And so I went back there and I talked to him about the law of tithing. And then I told him about the story that happened to me, as well as what happens. You know, not just to me, but anybody that pays for a full tithing, you will find that this principle is true. You know, it's a true principle of the gospel. And so I went back there and says, it's good that you donate, but if you don't pay 10%, it's just a donation. It's not a tithe. It's a donation.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a tithe, it's 10%. If you want to reap the blessings of being a full tithe payer, you pay 10% of your earnings to the church. You know, and the Lord will bless you for it. And that's been the case in my life, you know, and I'm sure it will be the same in yours, that you'll never be in want of food that they put on your table. And so, anyway, that's the reason that I went. And so when I got home, I asked Bob, well, how did they, because if you can, if the membership there, they had to bring another person with them. You know, they had to bring another person with them to listen to me talk. I don't know, that was an incentive, I guess, to get them there to listen to me because of the 60 World Series, you know, and everything. And they thought maybe we were going to talk baseball. I got home and I asked Bob, well, how did it go? And I said, the people accept, you know, what we talked about as being a full-time pair, 10%. And he said, well, you talked in the past, we thought there was about 8%, not quite 10. I said, well, there's probably some of them that did pay, you know, their full 10%. But then I hope that that was the case anyway. But,
sure. You made a good impression.
That we practice our whole life.
Oh, of course, yeah. Even when you were on the farm and your family struggled as mightily as they did, that was still a principle your family lived by?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, I still did that, yeah. Still, any money, because I worked. What I did, I worked when I got to high school. I moved back after the war and was in high school. I got a job at the creamery. I would get up about 5 in the morning, and because the farmers would start bringing their milk cans in to be dumped and to be taken samples for, to, you know, to get the cream intent, the amount of the cream that was involved in the milk, and so I did that. I did that every day, up until I signed a baseball contract, you know. And so, yeah, and then on Saturday would work the whole day, of course, you know. But Sunday was we did it on Sunday, but we did Monday through Friday through Saturday, and then actually Sunday was the day that we didn't have to do it. So. Yeah, but Vanita's saying to me, I said that there had to be somebody there.
Oh, sure, for the animals,
to empty the cans and so forth. But there were people that would work on Sunday too, you know, and not everybody was a member of the church, and so, you know, that was those people would be there to take care of it. But we did have Sunday off, and which is normal, because you just work every day and then have work all day Saturday. I guess they were, you know, were kind enough to let us, you know, just have the day off to do our Sunday business. So,
did you regard Branch Rickey as a? I know he was a very knowledgeable baseball man. Was he also a tough negotiator? A tough negotiator.
Negotiate
for a contract. You know, your
for a contract. There was 1 year that. I didn't have anybody to negotiate with me, but there was 1 year I think it was Herman Walker. More my dad, I think, had to do with it than Herman Walker. And that was, because I know, gosh, you know, I'm trying to think, but I think about it, I think it was Herman Welker. That did this. He thought that I had a good enough year that I deserved the raise, and I can't tell you which year it was. I think it was before. Branch Rickey. Branch came over. What was it? 56 that he was there.
He was there through 55.
55. Okay. Yeah. Well, it might have been.
He was there through 55, and then Joe Brown took over in 56.
Okay. Well, then it was with Joe Brown. It was with Joe Brown that this happened. That because I know it wasn't with Rickey. I think it was with Joe Brown. Mm. And so yeah, there was 1 year that I pitched well, you know, but nobody was, you know. This is when we were still not doing it, and we're making a lot of money. And Joel, he did. I said, Joel, I'm thinking ahead here, because Joel Brown came to our house, and this had to be after the World Series. And he laid out a contract on the table, and he says, Larry says, you had a great year, write down what you want. You know, and I was shocked by that. I never expected to hear that. And so I said, Joe, you know more about this than I do. I don't want to be, because there's other guys on the team. I've got to think about them. I can't throw out a figure, you know, that is ridiculous, you know. There's just no way I can do that. You know about what you can do, you know, and you handle it. You write it. You write a figure down. I'll sign it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did that. He wrote down $50,000. And I thought that was fair.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if I argued with him, I probably could have gotten more. I could say, well, what about some of the guys that I know that another teams are getting $100,000, you know? But I said, Joe, what about it? You write a figure in, and if I think it's fair, I'll sign it. And I did. That's what I did. Because I was thinking about my teammates too, not just me. You know, because I know that the other guys had great years too.
Well, when you did that, did you have a number in mind, you know, ahead of time that you thought, well, it's got to be at least this?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
I said, when you did that, you must have had a number in mind that you thought to yourself, well, I at least have to get.
Really? I did not have a number in my mind at all. Because I just let them take care of it, you know. I've done that. I've never argued with them about what I was making. You know, I remember Gus Bell, when Branch Rickey was there, he said, my wife is expecting, you know, and I need to have more money, you know, to take care of. And Branch Rickey said, well, Gus, I'm paying you to play baseball. I'm not raising babies, you know.
Boy. Yeah.
And so, you know, I felt bad about that, because Gus did have a good year. He deserved a good salary, but I didn't know what he was making. But anyway, that's the way it was back to us. You know, nobody knew who was making what.
So the players.
Yeah, if I'd have known, it made a difference. But I didn't know what our team was capable of doing or giving. I didn't want to be selfish. I just said, write in a figure, and I think it's fair, I'll sign it. So that's the way it was.
The Players Union was really pretty weak at that time, I guess. This is before Marvin Miller came in. And,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So didn't have, you know, they're really, you only had so much latitude with negotiation, I guess.
Right. Well, there's, you know, there are things that Marvin Miller did, you know, that was very good for the teams and negotiating and so forth. One thing that I'm really glad of, you know, that's been a savior for us is we're the ones that got the pension plan started.
Yes.
We took money out of our pockets to get it started. We played two All-Star games. We convinced the owners to put in a little bit during the World Series, you know, to help raise the fund and get it liable, you know, reliable and able to take care of some guys that's played before us, you know, that deserve to have some too, you know. But yeah, we're the ones that got it started. But now the guys today, as far as I'm concerned, they don't need a pension, because what they're making now, take care of the money, that's not a problem at all.
So, oh, sure.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, that's the way it is. So.
Well, and go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm getting a little bell every once in a while. I know my cell phone is about to quit on me.
Okay. this was great. I don't know. Would you mind going another time to go through some more? Or?
Yeah, if you've got the time, that's fine.
This is fantastic. I love these stories. We're only at 1955. we covered quite a bit of this 1960 season though, but I think this is a good time to break.